The Israeli onslaught in Gaza claims scores of more innocent lives in the northern and central parts of the beleaguered Palestinian territory. U.S. Defense Chief Lloyd Austin is meeting with Israeli officials in Tel Aviv in the midst of their genocidal war against Palestinians. British Petroleum suspends its oil tanker transit through the Red Sea as the Yemeni military continues targeting more Israel-bound vessels in retaliation for the genocide in Gaza. Welcome to World News. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, getting to the first story, of course, being Gaza, where death and destruction, dire shortages of food and water, and widespread displacement. This is the harsh reality facing 2.4 million Palestinians in Gaza as the Israeli regime continues its relentless strikes on the war-ridden strip. Scores of Palestinians have fallen victim to the regime's artillery targeting residential areas in the northern and central parts of Gaza. Now, the latest airstrikes on the Jabalia area have claimed over 110 lives. Air raids in a Nusrat camp in central Gaza have also left at least 50 people dead, and the regime's artillery shelled the maternity ward of the Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, killing a teenage girl and wounding a number of others. The Palestinian Red Crescent has slammed as extremely dangerous the shelling of the medical facility. Human Rights Watch has also warned that the regime is using starvation as part of its war campaign by blocking humanitarian aid and destroying agricultural land. Nearly 19,500 people in Gaza have so far been killed in Israeli attacks. Well, we were earlier joined by our correspondent in Gaza, Zder Al-Bala, with an update from the ground.
The last couple of hours were bloody and harsh for the Palestinian people and the Palestinian civilians across all areas of Gaza Strip. The Israeli airstrikes have never stopped for a while. The Israeli war plans have just targeted several residential buildings in the middle area of Gaza Strip, particularly Al-Maghazi and Al-Burij refugee camps, respectively. And more fire belts were carried out by the Israeli fighter jets against the agricultural lands in the middle area here in Gaza Strip. In Deir el-Balah particularly, the Israeli artillery maintained its shelling towards the houses of the Palestinian civilians, especially those who live in the eastern side and the eastern parts of Deir el-Balah city. And in other areas as well, particularly Gaza, inside Gaza city, the Israeli artillery also continued its shelling and targeting the residential neighborhoods, particularly Sheikh Ridwan and Ad-Daraj neighborhoods. We are talking about continuous Israeli airstrikes happening and taking place amid the continuous, relentless shelling practiced and carried out by the Israeli artillery. So we are talking about continuous targeting of the Palestinian residential houses, and we are in front of dozens of the Palestinian casualties and injuries on a recurring matter. These casualties are brought to the hospitals every moment.
Another U.S. official is in the occupied lands amid the Israeli regime's onslaught against the Gaza Strip. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin once again endorses Washington's unflinching support for Tel Aviv's genocide of Palestinians. And the Pentagon chief has already met with the regime's war minister, Yoav Gallant, in Tel Aviv. Austin is also expected to meet with other senior officials, Israeli officials, including Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, the meetings are expected to discuss Israel's plans for a transition to a so-called next phase of the war. Austin is the latest U.S. official to visit Israel since the regime began its bloodbath in Gaza in early October. Washington has been defying domestic and international outcries to stop supporting Israel's bombardment campaign against the defenseless women and children in the Palestinian territory. Well, the co-founder of the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier, says Washington tries hard to isolate the people of Gaza from any support, but failed.
America has worked very hard. Blinken was touring the region during the genocide in Gaza in order to isolate the people of Gaza and Palestine from any support across the region. But yet we see that support coming in. I mean, Israel has to be defeated in many, many different ways and probably several times before the threat can be lifted off the people of the region. And this military response from Yemen is very, very dramatic. I think in Washington, they're thinking, what on earth can we do? Can we expand the war to the entire region? But if they do that, there's 7 million Zionist Jews in Palestine and 300 million Arabs across the region who understand what's going on in Palestine, and the overwhelming majority in solidarity with the Palestinians. So I think the options of America, and I could be proven wrong, but I think America's options are limited. They've got two aircraft carriers to defend Israel. Are they going to send another couple of aircraft carriers off the coast of Yemen? I don't think so. I think that in this situation, America and Israel are coming up against the limitations of their power. They've come up against it before, of course, in Lebanon and elsewhere, but they're coming up again against the limitations of their ability to terrorize the entire region.
A senior member of the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, says the group will not enter to a prisoner swap agreement with Israel unless the regime stops its onslaught on Gaza. Khalil al-Hayya says it would not be sensible to sign a prisoner exchange deal while Palestinians are under fire. He also says Hamas has what it takes to resist for months, adding whoever thinks of a post-Hamas era is delusional. Al-Hayya has urged Muslim countries to force the Israeli regime into allowing humanitarian aid to enter Gaza. Now, the top Hamas official argued that the entry of 100 trucks with relief aid is not enough at all for besieged Gazans. He says the resistance front will continue to counter the occupiers and inflict further losses on them. Meanwhile, the military wing of the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, has responded to Israel's discovery of one of their tunnels on Sunday. The Al-Qassam Brigades has told the Israeli forces that they are too late. In a video, the resistance says that the tunnels discovered by Israel yesterday were the ones used in Operation Al-Aqsa Flood on October the 7th. On Monday, the Israeli army broadcasted videos of a resistance tunnel near the occupied territories, calling it the biggest one ever uncovered in the Gaza Strip. Now, the tunnel unveiled is only a small part of the network of underground passages in Gaza. It is completely isolated and hardly measures 1,500 meters in a straight line. And now to the West Bank, where Israeli forces kill more Palestinians there in the occupied territory as they raid the Farah refugee camp in the Jordan Valley. The Palestinian Health Ministry says 4 young Palestinians were killed by regime troops during the incursion. Palestinians were aged between 17 and 24. Israel has stepped up its raids and attacks across the occupied territories since October the 7th. That's when the regime began its onslaught on the Gaza Strip. Since then, regime forces and settlers have killed more than 300 Palestinians and detained hundreds of others across the West Bank. Well, Palestinians in the occupied West Bank say they will not leave their land despite the deadly Israeli raids. Now, this comes after Israel destroys the house of a Palestinian who's held in Israeli jails. The detainee's father says the regime is trying to force them out of the West Bank.
These are the targets of the Israeli regime inside Jenin refugee camp. The regime has bombed and destroyed houses of civilians while claiming it has targeted the resistance forces. This is a strategy that the regime has been using in Gaza. Israel kills innocent Palestinians and destroys their homes. Right now, we are standing on the rubble of a house that belonged to Tamer Mer'i, one of the Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails. The regime has bombed this house and razed a two-story structure. Adjacent buildings have also been destroyed. This is one of the thousands of houses in Jenin refugee camp that have been demolished during the regime's 60-hour operation. In this offensive, Israeli forces also partially destroyed several other buildings, arrested hundreds of people, and raided hundreds more houses and caused damage. Now we will talk to the father of Palestinian detainee, Mr. Mohamed Mar'i. Tell us what happened.
What happened was, thank God, I was not at home. There was no one in the house. I was out of the camp, but when I returned, I was shocked to see that they had blown up my house. Without any reason, they blew up the house. However, we will not abandon our home. This is our land. This is Palestine. And this area belongs to the camp. I'm not going to abandon the camp. I have grown up here, and I am not leaving it. Where are they forcing us to go? We will not leave the camp.
A global energy producer, British Petroleum, says it has suspended all oil tanker transit in the Red Sea over what it calls a deteriorating security situation in the area. Taiwan's container transportation company, Evergreen Line, has also halted shipments to and from the occupied lands in response to the recent attacks in the Red Sea. This after the Yemeni military attacked the Israel-bound ships in the Red Sea. In the latest of such attacks, Yemeni armed forces performed a special military operation against two ships related to the Israeli regime. Yemen's army spokesman says the operation targeted Swan Atlantic oil tanker and the MSC Clara container ship following the crew's refusal to follow the Yemeni army's orders. Sana'a says the strikes are in response to Israel's genocidal war on the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Yemen has stressed that it will continue the attacks until Tel Aviv stops its ethnic cleansing in Gaza and allows food and medicine into the blockaded strip. While there's been no let-up in Israeli atrocities in Gaza, people across the world have also been equally unwavering in their support for Palestinians in the besieged territory. Let's bring you up to date with some of the latest pro-Palestinian rallies. French protesters call for a total and permanent ceasefire. They carried banners calling for the right of life for people of Gaza and expressed support for the struggle of Palestinians for freedom. Across the channel and in the southeastern UK city of Brighton, people also marched in support of Palestinians. The rally was a culmination of 20 local groups, all calling for a ceasefire. Meanwhile, in the Canadian capital of Ottawa, protesters waved Palestinian flags and chanted Free, Free Palestine at a Zara store. Now, that's because of an ad campaign by the fashion brand featuring statues wrapped in white. Activists say the images resembled photos of corpses in white shrouds in Gaza. Zara withdrew the ad earlier in the week. Moving on to other news now this hour, the Israeli prime minister is facing harsh criticism at home over his handling of the issue of captives being held by Hamas. Israelis have been piling up the pressure on Netanyahu since three of those captives were killed by the regime's own forces in Gaza some days ago. One of the three slain captives was buried near Tel Aviv on Sunday. During the funeral, his brothers slammed the Israeli military for abandoning and murdering him. The three men were waving a white flag and were killed near Gaza City by the invading Israeli troops on Friday. It sparked protests in Tel Aviv, where people vented their anger at Netanyahu and called on him to initiate negotiations to get the captives released. More than 100 Israelis are still being held by Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza. That's after a week-long truce in late November saw Hamas swapping more than 100 captives with 240 Palestinian women and children held in Israeli jails. Israeli warplanes have carried out fresh strikes on Syria, targeting the vicinity of the capital, Damascus. According to the Syrian military, the rockets were launched from the direction of the occupied Golan Heights. It added that the country's air defenses intercepted and shot down most of the missiles. The offensive, however, left two people wounded and caused some material damage. Israeli regime frequently targets Syria particularly areas in and around the capital, Damascus. The Syrian government has on numerous occasions called on the United Nations to force the Israeli regime to stop its acts of aggression. Damascus says the assaults are in violation of international law and aimed at propping up terrorists. Well, now to South Korea, which says the Democratic People's Republic of Korea has launched another long-range ballistic missile that landed in the waters east of the Korean Peninsula. Officials in Seoul and Tokyo say the missile can potentially strike the United States. Japan's defense ministry says it was an intercontinental ballistic missile with a potential range of more than 15,000 kilometers. According to South Korea, the projectile flew up rather than across. Now, this is a method Pyongyang employs in some weapons testing to avoid flying over neighboring countries. The launch followed the test of a shorter-range missile on Sunday night. The DPRK says its missile tests are in response to the persisting joint war games by the U.S. and its regional allies and their hostile rhetoric. Pyongyang regards such moves as rehearsals for invasion. Well, a car crash targets the U.S. president's motorcade in Delaware. The car rammed into a Secret Service SUV, shielding the Joe Biden convoy.
Mr. President, why are you losing to Trump in the polls?
Reporters were asking Biden about his low polling numbers when the crash took place. He was leaving his campaign headquarters in Wilmington. The U.S. president was quickly ushered into his waiting vehicle, where his wife was already seated. The Wilmington Police Department said in a statement it is investigating the collision, which did not result in any injuries. And with that, brings us to the end of this Worldless edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime's destruction and kidnappings of theater staff are part of a wider attempt to break Palestinians in the West Bank psychologically and emotionally. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, when Mustafa Shetta, a father of four and the general manager at the Freedom Theater, was abducted from his home recently and blindfolded, incarcerated, beaten and deprived of food or water, it was not a random event. The Zionist regime troops, who were half his age, had asked neighbors where he lived. They'd come looking for this portly, middle-aged artistic producer specifically. Nobody would mistake Shetta, a gentleman with a fatherly demeanor, for a terrorist. He was not a military target. They beat him up for being the general manager of a theater. That was his crime. But the current Israeli regime invasion of the Jenin refugee camp is an exercise in torture with no military objective. Since dawn, the Jenin Brigade fighters had been exchanging gunfire with the Zionist regime army in nearby Jenin City, leaving Jenin camp empty of armed militants. The Zionist regime army took advantage of this and abducted over 500 people inside the camp, including Sheta. Around 100 people were abducted, the majority of them men or youths. Ahmad Tobasi, the creative director of the Freedom Theater, was one of them. He confronted the Zionist regime troops recently, asking why they were attacking the theater. They beat him and raided his home, smashed his computer, his iPad, and plants before abducting him. Tobasi is no stranger to the Zionist regime's brutality. He says his earliest memory was being kicked by an Israeli troop when he was a child, hiding in the alleyway next to his humble home. He was also abducted as a youth. But then, Giuliano Merchamis, who founded the Freedom Theater, Ben Tobasi now leads, took him under his wing and gave him the work in the theater. It was this work that gave Tobasi the chance to travel to Norway, where he lived, worked, and attained Norwegian citizenship. But it was his courage and sense of cultural pride that brought him back to Jenin camp and ultimately led to him being singled out by the Zionist regime troops and given the beating this week that left bruises on his legs and back. These wounds are a visceral acknowledgement of his ability to inspire hope and dreams in the youth of Jenin. Jamal Abu Jaz was also abducted by the Zionist regime troops who were beating him. Abu Jaz is one of the theater's trainers for the younger members, and he was part of the summer camp teaching crew. Not a dangerous guy, unless your fear is the social cohesion of a community under siege and passing on a sense of self, continuity, and Palestinian pride. If this is what you fear, it makes sense to beat up and incarcerate this sensitive, kind young poet whose nerves are now shot and who smokes a lot of cigarettes to help him deal with what is now behind his sad eyes and shy smile. Abu Jaz was severely beaten and his camera and phone were stolen. Hanin Amin, director of the Palestinian Authority's Ministry of Culture, said numerous homes in the camp, including those belonging to individuals working in the cultural field, were raided. These savage attacks directly target everything that enhances national and cultural consciousness through the creative role played by these institutions and individuals, contributing to the enhancement and narration of the Palestinian story in the voices of its people and preserving national identity through their arts and culture. The electricity, water, and internet were cut off days ago. The roads have been destroyed again by modified Caterpillar bulldozers known as D9s. Military dogs were sent into refugees' homes along with tear gas grenades. The constant rattle of gunfire was all around and sounded like raindrops. For weeks, the roads remained denuded of their tarmac, waiting for the Palestinian Authority to patch up the broken pipes and snapped wires to repave the blacktop surface that allows kids to be driven to school and ambulances to make it to the hospital in time. This is one reason why their surface is yet again destroyed and everyone's hearts are breaking. There is certainly a practical reason for destroying stuff. It makes life hard. Breaking roads means less movement. But it's not only about this. In fact, we would suggest it's more about the psychological aspects of war. It's about making the camp's residents feel powerless. It's about making them give up and move to Jordan. And what could be more demoralizing than smashing the internal walls of a much-loved theater with mallets, than blindfolding the theater staff in front of their families, handcuffing them, and shooting rapid rounds of live ammunition inside the theater itself, all while it's around 16 degrees outside and raining. Surprisingly, perhaps, there is a good answer to this rhetorical question, and it turns out that there were other ways the Zionist regime forces could find to break the Palestinian spirit, blasting recordings of Hanukkah songs over the tannoy system of the main mosque in the center of Jenin refugee camp, while the Zionist troops spray the Star of David into residents' homes and hang Israeli flag on their buildings. Momen Saadi, an actor and educator at the Freedom Theatre's school, says, "This is the ugliness of the occupation. The occupation encroaches on our property, works on westernization, and sings disgusting songs. Nothing shouts colonizer like a flag on a post, especially when paired with these acts of cultural genocide, defined in the Hague Convention, Road Pact and World Heritage Convention, all flagrantly broken and bruised, alongside the bones and bodies of colleagues and friends." Wafa, a 26-year-old mother and homemaker whose husband is unemployed as a direct result of the Zionist regime's violence, and whose one-year-old has not been able to access formula milk for weeks and is no doubt now undernourished, said, "Mina, it's terrifying. My children are terrified by the sound of the roaring and the screaming. Our neighborhood is full of troops. My husband is very nervous. They say the Israeli troops beat them until they faint." Her husband was subsequently abducted by the Zionist regime forces. "This feels like a moment to mention the fate of the much-loved horse sculpture that lived by the gate to the camp, which was taken hostage by the Zionist regime troops, and the giant gates that framed the entrance on the other side, which have now been ruined in this depraved orgy of cultural destruction. Punishing the resistance by attacking a monument and abducting a horse as a hostage. This is what oppression looks like visually, like broken bits of horse statues." It's also about eradicating a culture. But you can't erase the collective yearnings and communal memories of a people simply by blowing it up. Their targets are non-combatants. They are mothers, dads, kids, the elderly. So why the tear gas, incessant low-flying drones and bulldozers? Why the warplanes dropping air-to-land missiles and the anti-tank grenades with the super loud booms that haunts dreams from the first time kids hear them in Jenin to the last time they hear them in Nablus? The rumor was that this siege would last 5 more days, like the siege in the Second Intifada, when Jenin camp was etched into the pages of history. In the first 72 hours, at least 12 men were killed, and one young boy, Bashar Haruni, whose voice hadn't yet dropped. The 12th to die was a student at the Freedom Theater, 16-year-old Musa Ibn Malik, a joyful, shy boy. Her mother stayed a long time with her sisters and brothers during the Zionist regime's invasion of Jenin camp in September.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
So dear brothers and sisters in Islam, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Our topic this time has been raising Fatimiyun, which meant we were employing karama. You see, the Kareem, in his eyes or her eyes, God is so grand, so great. The Kareem values that relationship with God. There are many things you can bargain with, barter over. For the Kareem, nothing is as valuable as my relationship with my Lord. I can't compromise that. I can't please this or that one and sacrifice that. I value the relationship with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You see, with some people, they think, well, this is just a minor sin. It's no biggie. It's okay. Right? They're finding a way to justify violating Allah's commands. How does Zahra teach us to think? How does a Kareem view God? This is from the hadith from our Prophet. He says this, Ya Aba Dhar. So our Prophet speaking to Aba Dhar. La tandur ila sigharil khati'a. Don't look at how small the sin is. Don't look at how small the sin is. Walakin undur ila man asait. Look at who you're defying. How great is God? It's not about how small the sin is. God in the eyes of the Kareem is too important for me to violate his laws, to trample his laws. The Kareem, the person who has a sense of karama, of Islamic self-worth and self-dignity, also has another strong point. They value themselves as the best of Allah's creation. Their self-worth, they have Islamic self-worth. I'm the best of Allah's creation. Where do we find that in the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt? I'm more important, me as a believer, as a mu'min or mu'mina, I'm more important than the dunya. Other people, the dunya, a loss in the dunya, a setback in the dunya is breaking them. For me, I'm more important than the dunya wa ma fiha. Where does we learn that from the hadith? It's from Imam Ali. He says, لَيْسَ لِأَنفُسِكُمْ ثَمَنٌ إِلَّا الْجَنَّةِ. You have no price other than paradise. فَلَا تَبِعُوهَا إِلَّا بِهَا. Don't sell yourselves for anything less. They give you the entire dunya. Don't sell yourself for anything less. So what we find, though, is the opposite for the person who's not Kareem. For the Kareem, their test, their what was keeping them was that relationship with God, my self-worth as God's Khalifa. If I don't have Islamic self-worth, if I don't see myself as being valuable, the opposite effect is true. The dunya becomes everything for this person. Some people have a different test, as I mentioned. Some people, their test is, other people are pressuring me to sin for your wedding. It's one night. It's okay. Do it for me. Right? The pressure. The non-kareem, when they see those other tragedies, afflictions, and again, there's a whole laundry list of afflictions and things people are going through, when they see those, the non-kareem, when they see these things, it says, manhanat alayhi nafsu. The person who has no self-worth, no Islamic self-worth. Kaburat dunya fi ayni. The dunya is so big in this person's eyes. Everything is the dunya. What will people think? What will people say? The opposite of the kareem. Right? So all of that displaced anger, all of that comes as a result of? Now, There is one kind of thought for some of us to have, and that is that our discussion is actually, one part of it is about raising children. So it's kind of almost an eye roll moment. Sheikh, I get it. If you're talking about us as adults, yeah, the dunya, it's a big thing. We shouldn't make it a big thing. The dunya's worthless. How can I train a child to think that the dunya is worthless? How can, you're saying, raise children to be kareem. How can children learn that the dunya is worthless? For this, there are three answers, brothers and sisters. Three things for us to consider. The first thing is, in this discussion about karama, we're focusing on children who are not toddlers. We're talking about children 7 and older. We're talking about the second, our training for them. Yes, of course, we treated them in a such a way they were raised to be kareem from the time they were younger. But these discussions that we're having, these conversations that we're having, we're not talking about me trying to convince a toddler. The second problem is this. Who says that tarbiyah is me telling a child, sit down, let me give you a lecture. I'm going to quote a hadith for you about how worthless the dunya is. Sit down and let me lecture you. Who said that's tarbiyah? We can talk about something else for tarbiyah. Now you might follow that up with, well, are we not supposed to talk about the dunya to children then? No, you're supposed to talk about the dunya to children. Let me share a secret with you. Your children were born on the fitrah. We have hadith about this. Their fitrah is untainted. They're purer than you and I. They haven't been polluted like you and I. The fitrah is untainted. Because the fitrah is untainted, if the parent or the teacher knows how to explain these concepts, the child will get it. They understand. The fitrah that they have is that the dunya isn't that important. That's just up to you and I now. Do we know how to carefully select a hadith, ayat, stories to help impress upon this child the idea that the dunya is worthless? Your real goal is something else. You're bigger than this dunya. That's up to us. How do we do that? Do we have the skill to do that? But the third thing is this. Our children are supposed to learn this from our actions. There's one time when we're trying to lecture somebody, right? Another time it's on me as a parent. You're supposed to see from your interactions with me, or me as a teacher, or me as a big brother, or me as a big sister. If you're trying to do tarbiyah, you're supposed to see from looking at me that the dunya is indeed worthless. It's trivial. This behavior, teaching through actions, stays with children. So now, what happens is that our children are supposed to, what happens is these ayat of the Quran, I'm going to share some of the ayat of the Quran, they're supposed to be embodied. The children are supposed to see this in our eyes. Other people see setbacks, so setbacks would break someone. For the kareem who's embraced Quran and Sunnah, they say what Allah says. وَتِلْكَ الْأَيَّامُ نُدَاوِلُهَا بَيْنَ النَّاسِ. Such days we make rotate amongst the people. Yes, sometimes there are defeats. Sometimes there's victories. Sometimes it wins. Sometimes we have money. Sometimes we don't. The children need to see from my behavior that tilka ayat, ayat of Quran, this is surah 3, verse number 140. But tilka ayam nudawiluha bayna nas. We make these days rotate amongst the people. But I need to see somebody acting on that in order for me to be convinced. That kind of tarbiyah. Allow me to say a story that's not true, inshallah. They said once, this neighbor was watching this little boy. He was in his backyard. And the little boy had a baseball bat. And the little boy loudly said, I'm the greatest home run hitter in the world. And he threw the ball up into the air. And he swung with all his might and he missed. And he said, strike one. But the little boy didn't get disappointed. He threw the ball up in the air again. He said, I'm the greatest home run hitter in the world. And he swung again, and again he missed. But again, he didn't get demoralized. He got the ball for the last time. Little boy throws the ball up in the air. I'm the greatest home run hitter in the world. He swings and he misses. Then he says, you know what? I just found out I'm the greatest strikeout artist in the world. However it works, God's on the side of the mu'min. These are ayat of the Quran, but our children need to see that. I tried my best. I pushed. It wasn't my fault. I did everything I can. That means God has a better plan for me. That's how the children learn about the dunya, right? So the verse says this. So Surah 4, verse number 19. Fa'asa an takrahu shay'a. Many times you dislike something. It's a setback. It's uncomfortable. It's not fair. It's not right. Fa'asa an takrahu shay'a. You dislike something. وَيَجْعَلَ اللَّهُ فِيهِ خَيْرًا كَثِيرًا. But Allah put a lot of good in it. I serve a good God. God's on my side.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل عليه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
It has been revealed that the Zionist bombing campaign has totally destroyed one of Gaza's most important cultural centers. The Rashad al-Shawa Theater had been a beacon of cultural vibrancy for over two decades, a place of performance, poetry, music, art, and local engagement. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media website and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, the Rashad al-Shawa Cultural Center was where it all started for artist Anas Abu Aita. The center was where, for years, Abu Aita performed in the theater. The center, located in Gaza City's Al Rimal neighborhood, opened in 1985. It was named after Palestinian businessman Rashad al-Shawa, who served as mayor of Gaza in 1970s. Designed by Syrian architect Saad Mohafel, the three-story building was constructed in the brutalist style and had a library, roomy lounges to host cultural events, and most notably, the Great Theater. During the Zionist regime's attacks on Gaza, many Palestinians took shelter there. Then, the Zionist regime destroyed the center in an airstrike. The center now lies in ruins. Abu Aita is devastated about the loss of the theater, as it was a place that showed more than what was sad about Gaza. It also showed its beautiful reality. Abu Aita took to the stage in October 2010 to perform in the Gaza Monologues at the Rashat Shawa Cultural Center. The monologues were compiled by the Ashtar Theater Group as a response to the Zionist regime's brutal attacks on Gaza from December 2008 to January 2009. Each monologue is in the voice of a young person from Gaza. They tell of how they survived that war and how they are continuing to live under the Zionist regime siege. Abu Aita recalled that performing the monologues felt powerful, since he was able to help bring those words to life. Recently, Ashtar encouraged people around the world to gather in groups and read the monologues. In 2014 and 2015, Abu Aita performed in a piece titled We Speak About Palestinians' Experiences of Displacement and Death During the Zionist Regime's 2014 War on Gaza. It was also about how to preserve their dreams amid war. Abu Aita remembers the reactions of the audience during these performances, how he could feel both their sadness and joy. Many attendees cried afterward. He has now performed at many theaters throughout the West Asia region, telling the stories of Palestinians living under occupation and siege. But his memories of those performances at the Al-Shawa Center are special. After the Zionist regime's destruction of the theater, he's unsure what will happen next. The Al-Shawa Center was much more than a theater. Every year, Palestinian vendors would gather there to sell paintings and other local crafts. It was the hub of cultural and educational gatherings in Gaza, art exhibitions, film screenings, and even school graduations. Abu Aita said, "It was a hopeful place for all of us." The Al-Shawa Center was an important place for many Palestinian artists. Palestinian director Khalil Mozan recalled on Facebook how the center hosted the 2016 Human Rights Film Festival. Palestinian writer Aziz Al-Masri told the Electronic Intifada that the center, which he called one of Gaza's oldest and largest cultural centers, helped him become a writer and researcher on Palestinian history. He said, "The bombing and destruction of the center cannot be separated from the context of the central objective of the war, which is to destroy Gaza with all its social and cultural pillars. It's a major loss for the people of Gaza," he said. The center was a genuine cultural platform that helped shape Gaza's culture for decades. Al-Masri said that the Zionist regime's destruction of the center is one more example of its targeting of Gaza's landmarks. Meanwhile, Middle East Monitor wrote, "The Israeli occupation army has destroyed 192 mosques in the besieged Gaza Strip since October 7th. The Zionist regime's media outlets have also reported. Recently, Israeli regime warplanes launched raids on the historic Omari Mosque in the old city of Gaza City, destroying large parts of it. Founded more than 1,400 years ago, the mosque is considered one of the largest and most ancient mosques in Gaza, and the third largest mosque in the occupied Palestine after the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Ahmad Pasha Al-Jazar in Arq. The locals refer to the mosque as the Little Al-Aqsa Mosque due to its similarity to Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied Al-Quds, which they cannot access due to the Zionist regime siege on Gaza. The mosque area is estimated at about 4,100 square meters, while the area of its courtyard reaches 1,190 square meters. The interior building includes 38 marble columns. Since launching its genocidal bombing campaign in Gaza recently, the Zionist regime has deliberately targeted all kinds of infrastructure in Gaza with the goal of making the strip uninhabitable and ethnically cleansing it of its Palestinian residents. Targets have included universities and schools, including UN schools housing tens of thousands of displaced families, daycare centers, libraries and educational centers, hospitals and places of worship, including churches.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khamenei, in a meeting with Iran's sports champions and medalists of the 2023 Asian Games and the Asian Paragames. This meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyye on November 22, 2023. I would like to thank our female athletes. I would like to thank the woman who carried the flag in the opening ceremony during this round of the Asian Games while wearing full hijab. She showed the identity and character of an Iranian woman to the entire world. I would like to thank the female athlete who refused to shake hands with a non-mahram man, not from her intimate family, during the awards ceremony. He extended his hand toward her, but she declined to take it. These are very significant things. These things are just as important as sports are, if not more. I would like to thank the woman who went to the podium with her baby. She went on the podium with her baby in her arms and received her medal. This was a symbolic move. In the world, this shows a woman respecting the role of the family and the role of a mother.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I would like to thank the athletes who included their values and beliefs in their sports activities. They prostrated to God after their victory, raised their hands in the prayer in the middle of the sporting arena, kissed the Iranian flag, and prostrated on the flag. These are very important things. These are acts that not only demonstrate the identity of Iranian Islamic athlete, but also the identity of the Iranian nation before the eyes of hundreds of millions of spectators. These are not small things. Such a prostration is very different from the prostration that one does at home or in a mosque. This chador in such a situation is very different from the chador that someone wears on the streets of Tehran. I would like to thank the national soccer team, which showed their support for the Palestinian cause by wearing kifias when they came onto the field. I would like to thank each of the athletes who took a stand in one way or another in support of Palestine, declared their stance before the world, not in hiding, gifted their medals to the children of Gaza and the martyrs who were killed in a hospital, where the Zionist regime created a catastrophe. I would also like to thank the athletes who refused to compete with the athletes of the Zionist regime. The correctness of what they did has become clear today. The truth behind this is more apparent than ever today. These are things I am grateful for.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.